begin, since you're going to receive an entire graduate seminar in legal theory today, figure we may as well do it in 55 minutes and see how far we get. I don't know how the tape ministry is doing this. I'm going to assume this thing is going, or they're listening to me now, so we're about to begin. My name is Eric Jorstad, and this is the third in our series, Faith and Law. The title today is, What is Law? Now, Herman Ruther came up to me this morning and said, well, Eric, I see you have another one of your nice specific subjects to take on today. And I realize how incredibly global a sweep a title like that is. I'm assuming that this is somewhat of a self-selecting kind of group. A title like What is Law is not going to appeal to everybody in Holden Village, I don't suspect. So I'm going to assume that you have a particular interest in questions of law and that you are not here to be passive recipients of the knowledge from on high. I'm not going to be a judge handing down decisions today, but we're going to work together on our subject and try to come to grips with what I'm going to present as several different ways of understanding what law is from the legal side of, from the legal community, and then try to apply that to Lutheran theology. Lutherans who say at the heart of our doctrine is the law and the gospel. If we look at what law means in secular society as the function of the legal system, maybe there's something that it can teach us about law and gospel in a theological sense. So we've got some hard work. I hope you've got your intellectual seatbelts fastened, because we're going to be going over some rough terrain. It's a little hard in this room. I feel like I'm talking to 400 people, but I have to talk that loud so you can hear me. But it's just us. So I hope you can speak up and we can try to get some sense of a working group together here. To start with, I'd like us to turn to three passages in the Bible and see what we can learn about what is law in there. The first is Romans chapter 2. Those of you who are just coming in, there's Bibles up here. You know this one? Okay. Well, good Lutheran pastor has the Bible memorized. Okay. You probably have this passage memorized. Romans 2, 14 and 15. I want you each to be able to see this in front of you, because it's not the kind of thing you can just hear and immediately make sense of. We could do a whole sermon on the context here, but let's just plunge in with the two verses. When Gentiles who have not the law do by nature what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that what the law requires is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or perhaps excuse them. According to this passage, what is law? To start with, where is law? It's within. It's written on the heart. But there's really two different kinds of law that this is talking about. What's the law which the Gentiles don't have? Law of Moses. They don't have the Ten Commandments. They don't have the 623 rules of the covenant code. But does that mean they have no law? They have the law written on their hearts. And Paul uses an important word here in verse 14. While the Gentiles have not the law, do by nature. They have what's called the natural law, the law of nature, written on their hearts, which distinguishes good and evil. Well, that's the first conception of law in the Bible. Let's turn to Matthew 23 now. Matthew 23, verses 23 and 24. This is Jesus in a series of woes upon the Pharisees. It's actually the scribes and the Pharisees. It could be translated the lawyers and the Pharisees, in a sense. Jesus is arguing with the lawyers. In verse 23 and 24, we read, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides, straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel." Wonderful humor there. How does Jesus feel about the law in this passage? What's he criticizing the Pharisees for? Neglecting the important parts? The important issues. What do the Pharisees take care of, or what do they observe?
The minor
things? The kind of the particular petty little details that makes it look like you're following the letter of the law is what the Pharisees are following. But the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith, is what they're neglecting. It's almost as if there's two different parts of the law. That the law isn't just a set of rules which you follow or you don't, where it tells you how to wash your hands or how to prepare your food, and then you do it. But that there's principles in the law. There's weightier matters. There's the important or the core values of what the law is, which Jesus says they're neglecting. And what's Jesus' attitude towards those weightier matters? Does he tell them that no, the law is superseded, no, the law doesn't count? He says, "And these things you ought to have done." The weightier matter of the law is crucial to Jesus. Well, let's turn finally to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 to 9. If there's a more important passage in the Old Testament, I ask you to show it to me. Verses 4 to 9. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be upon your hearts, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise, and you shall bind them as a sign upon your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." How important are the commands of the Lord? How important is the law for the Old Testament community? Very important. Is it an external thing or an internal thing? Is it a law in the heart, or is it a law that's laid upon them from outside?
Both.
It's to be to love the Lord your God with all your heart, and you shall take these words to be upon your heart. But they're also to be taught to your children. They're also to be meditated upon, to be written on your doorposts and so on. It's both an external code, but it's also an internal commitment to be a part of this community, fellowship or community of people who are part of this one law, who share the law. So it's not something laid down upon them. It's a community of people whose way of life is determined internally and from the outside by the law. Well, those three passages are going to come back to inform us a bit later. What we see is four different notions of what the law is in these passages. First, in Romans, we see what's called natural law, the law of nature, which even the Gentiles, everybody knows what's right and what's wrong. In Matthew, we see two conceptions of the law. One, a kind of formalistic legalism, which has the Pharisees following the letter of the law, but neglecting what's the third conception of law, that the law is a matter of weight and principles, that there's core values which have to do with what the law is. And finally, fourth, we see law as a community of people committed to the principles of that law in the community and in relationship. So there's four different notions of law here. Before I launch into a history of law since the time the Bible was completed, I want to sort of pick your brains for a minute. What notions, what ideas come to your mind when you think of law? What are words and concepts associated with law for you?
Order.
What?
Order.
Law and order seems to come together almost immediately, doesn't it?
Courts.
So you think of the institutions that have to do with laws. Yeah.
Structure.
Order. Police. Oh, that's an institution of the law. What's the opposite of structure and order?
Chaos.
So what's the opposite of law?
Chaos.
There's something about what's not law is a kind of lawlessness which causes us all to be afraid. Any other notions that come to mind when you think of law?
Right and wrong.
Right and wrong? The law shows you what's right and punishes you if you do what's wrong?
Or to know the difference.
Law teaches you to know the difference.
Fairness.
Run that?
Fairness.
Fairness. Law as fairness.
Justice.
That law has something to do with not just order, but a particular kind of order. Not just a structure, but a structure which establishes a principle of justice and fairness, a way of creating relationships between people, such that people tend to do what's right, and if they do what's wrong, then they're punished or rehabilitated or something. If you're here last week, you know that discussion. Well, I'd like to put four words on the board, which I think we sometimes mix up. We sometimes sort of confuse, put them all together, and expect one to have to do with all the others. Law, justice. Society and power, that's counting as one. It's hard to write. It's a little more. And sin. I was surprised we didn't have any theological connotations to the word law when we did our word association. We connect law with justice, and we think what law accomplishes is justice. But I was interesting that what came out first was order. What law has to do with first in our mind is often to do with society and power. What law does is structure society in a certain way. Now, if you were a black living in Detroit in 1966, you would have had a different answer about what is law. law would have been, or police, wouldn't have been associated with order. It would have been associated with an occupying army of oppression. The police force was, I don't know the exact figure, but it was in the 95%+ range of white and was incredibly brutal in the black community in Detroit. And the police enforced a certain kind of power relationship within society. And it's no surprise that a year later, we call it most people call it the riots in Detroit. And the black residents of Detroit call them the insurrection, or the rebellion. This wasn't random riots, it was more of a kind of an unformed revolution. But we also expect, sort of playing on the theme of morality, can tie into here, we expect law to show us the difference between what's right and what's wrong. And that we connect structure and order with justice, with what's right. And if there's disorder or injustice, we equate it with sin. But I think the four of these really are separate concepts that all, well, gosh, I reached out here and intersect that. I'm not an artist. I studied math for a while. All of these are supposed to intersect here. Anyway, these are all four intersecting, but they all have separate identities. And if we try to equate law as simply showing us what sin is, Lutherans call it the second use of the law. Law convicts of sin. If we simply see law as having to do with society and power relationships, then we've missed a moral dimension of the law. If we simply equate law and justice, and some people call it our justice system, which is what the courts and the police have to do, I tend to call it our law enforcement system, because what the police and the courts do is enforce the laws. Whether they actually provide justice or not is not quite so clear. So now that I've thoroughly confused things and brought a host of different notions into play, I'd like to take 10 minutes and lecture before we launch into some more discussion. I'm going to try to put the history of legal theory. Dave, you're going to appreciate my traipse through legal theory here. We do have one lawyer, I hope you don't mind my saying that, in our midst, who will correct me on points where I'm misguided.
You have two.
Two lawyers, okay, good. Now you've taught some, are you a practicing attorney?
Mm-hmm.
What's your area?
Mostly real estate, commercial litigation.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see how you feel that fits into here. Do you think, just to ask, put you on the spot for a minute here, since you spoke up, that the laws having to do with property necessarily equate with justice?
No, but the way you have them overlapping here brought a strange thought to my mind, but I don't know how I want to put it out because it's probably on a totally different subject. Mm-hmm. I'll save it for later.
Okay, we're going to have a chance here for discussion after my little bit here. We're going to be able to go into it. Well, I'm glad we have people. We have at least a couple other pastors here who can correct me on Luther's theology if I stray too far. Let me sit down. I want to talk about the development of legal theory in four different ways of understanding the law. The first one is natural law. And I only want to go back as far as the 1200s, Thomas Aquinas. Natural law posits something called human nature. Now, I don't know how many of you have talked about human nature is this and human nature is that, but according to natural law, human nature has certain characteristics which are eternally true. One of them is dignity. The importance and value of every person. Another is fairness, that people should be treated with fairness. We could spin out what are, examples of principles of natural law, An obvious example that's pointed to is that something like murder or stealing is condemned in almost every society. There's Eskimos up in the north which don't always condemn murder the way we would define murder. But it's almost universal that murder is against the law wherever you are. It violates human nature to take another life without a justifiable reason. So human laws have validity only insofar as they accord with human nature, with the natural law. Let's see what state most of you are from. Are you from Washington or Minnesota or California? How many are from California? Washington. Minnesota. Minnesota? Well, I'm going to do Minnesota anyway. It's pretty close, Minnesota. I know Minnesota better. Say, was it Perpich still a governor there?
Yes.
He's, okay. Say the state legislature in Minnesota passes a certain law, and Rudy signs it. The governor of Minnesota signs it. That law, according to natural law theory, would really be a law only if it was in agreement with natural law. Natural law always stands as a kind of umbrella concept to judge any particular laws. And you, sincere and moral persons, are obligated to obey the law only if it's in accord with natural law. So what is real law is natural law. Human laws only count if they're in accord with natural law. So let me draw a little picture here. We're going to get geometry all over this board. Now what's important for Christians in particular, like Aquinas, is that God is the source of natural law. God made us a certain way. And so natural law comes from God. It influences states. It's determined by theologians. Theologians are higher than kings, according to natural law. Try that one in a courtroom these days. And all of that affects human actions. So the law comes from God or from nature, from human nature. It's filtered through states who have the power to punish. But the theologians can determine when the states are wrong. And all of that influences human actions. It's designed to mold, to tell us what's right and wrong, to mold the way that we live and our societies. Well, with the development of strong kings and strong nation states in the late Middle Ages, and as England in particular was developing, the kings and so on didn't like the thought of archbishops and popes telling them what was the law and what they could do, to set limits upon what they could enforce. And a new notion of law started to develop, which I'm going to call positivism. Positivism takes this precisely the same diagram, only it changes some of the characters. Replacing God is the state or the government. I use the word state generically, kind of with a capital S. I don't mean the state of Minnesota or Washington, but the state, any government. And it's now the state which determines what the law is. And the law, according to a famous formulation by a guy named Austin, is simply the commands of a sovereign backed by force. The law is what the king tells you to do, and if you don't do it, you're going to get punished. Doesn't have anything in particular to do with justice, doesn't matter what human nature has to say about it, Doesn't matter whether you like it, and it doesn't matter what the Pope or the theologians or the Archbishop has to say. It's the state which has the power to tell you what the law is. And so what does a court do in this case? The court just tries to determine what the facts of a case are, and then define what law applies to them. And it's a simple question of applying the law, as it's written in the code books by the government, and applying that law to facts. And that's what a trial is. Well, along around the 1890s came along Oliver Wendell Holmes. By the 1930s, there was a movement called legal realism. It's amazing how fast MLP is, isn't it? And they came up with a different idea from their experience. These were all law school teachers and practicing lawyers. These were no more philosophers, and they certainly weren't theologians, who said, no, law doesn't work quite that way. It's not really the state which tells the people what the law is, and then the people do it. But the law has more to do with the practices of the people. And the law simply confirms the structure of society, the values of society, and so on. Legal realism said that natural law in particular, they called it transcendental nonsense. With the heaven of legal ideas, there's this wonderful article that's just great satire. Not trying to criticize law in relation to sin or to justice, but saying all this wonderful stuff about human nature and natural law and God being the source of it all has absolutely nothing to do with what goes on in a courtroom, and certainly shouldn't influence what a judge says when he tries to make a decision. They call that all transcendental nonsense. But law is also more than rules simply handed down by the state, because the state doesn't exist in a vacuum. How does Ronald Reagan decide what policies to pursue? Well, I don't think he's like the philosopher Descartes, who went and sat by himself in a quiet room and determined what is reason and truth. I have the feeling there are pollsters and so on who help him determine what course of action. He's determined his course of action, the laws that he pursues, are determined in part by what's going on in society, at least in part. And a whole new understanding of the law has developed. Depending on who you talk with, trying to define what is the social structure that determines what the law is. Now, if you talk to blacks in Detroit in the mid-1960s, the law is simply determined by racism. If you talk to some contemporary feminists who are analyzing laws, particularly rape and battery laws, from the perspective of feminism, they'll say what determines what the law is the sexism that pervades society. If you talk to a Marxist who analyzes society in terms of class divisions and the hostility between social classes, he or she will tell you that the law is simply the tip of the iceberg, sort of the surface appearance of structures of class oppression. Laws don't have anything to do with justice, and it's not just the state which hands down the laws. Laws are a function of human society. And these days there's two big popular schools on the left and on the right. If you go to the University of Chicago Law School, you'll get the economics of law, saying that the real heart of the law is efficiency. And what judges are always trying to do is to maximize efficiency, a good free enterprise model. But it's really a form of the social science of law, as I call it, saying that law is a function of human actions. And if you go to Harvard Law School, you'll find the CRITs, the critical legal studies people, who are kind of peculiar neo-Marxists, and I'd love to talk about them at great length, because I'm a little more sympathetic to them than the Chicago School, but not ultimately sympathetic to them. And they, I'm just going to leave it at that, that they are, their approach is also a social science of law. I'll talk about that one if you want to later. Well, I want to propose a fourth model, that the law isn't simply something that's handed down by God or by nature, to direct our actions. Nor is the law simply handed down by the state, enforced by the sword to guide our actions. Nor is the law simply something that rises out of the way society is arranged. But there's an interaction among them all. I'm going to have to expand the triangle a little here. The law is in the middle of three sets of forces, at least. First, we can't understand laws except the fact that they are issued by states which can enforce them with sanctions. If you don't agree with your preacher, if you do something opposite of what the preacher says, well, you might get scolded from the pulpit the following week. In some churches, you might even get kicked out, but you're not going to be put in prison. You're not going to have property taken away from you. You're not going to lose your life. But the state can do all of that. Think about the law which the state can enforce. But the law isn't simply created in a vacuum by the state. It's influenced by human experience. But human experience isn't just something which you analyze. I'm going to present an alternative to the economics and the Marxist and the feminist and the racist understanding of a broader concept. Political theory is the third factor which determines what the law is. What I mean by political theory is that we hold in our society, to just choose our country for an example, constellations or clusters of principles which tell us how we believe society ought to be arranged. I don't think there's one single cluster of principles which simply defines our country. Some people would like to call anyone who disagrees with them un-American, but I think there's more to it than that. You can have your free enterprise, opportunity, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, individual initiative, constellation of principles. On the one hand, you can have your care for the poor, social equality, redistribute the wealth, care for the neediest and the weakest members of our society, guarantee that care. As another constellation of principles. You could probably pick out some others, and we probably have different ones among us here. But it's not an infinite universe of clusters of principles. There's a handful of these clusters, which are always competing to be able to define what the law is. When a judge sits in his chair, what I want to suggest is he or she is influenced by the state which has passed its particular laws, by the human experiences which have gone to form who that judge is, but also by the political theory, by the orientation, the general orientation of that judge. Now, in simple cases, none of this really makes a whole lot of difference. I mean, if you're trying to decide whether somebody went 65 miles an hour in a 55 mile an hour zone, political theory doesn't have a whole lot to do with it. But if you're trying to decide, say, Roe versus Wade regarding abortion, principles have a little bit more to do with deciding that kind of a case, or one's political theory, whether one stresses autonomy or equality, and so on, as cardinal principles will determine how you come out on the case. Or Brown versus Board of Education, when the Supreme Court outlawed segregated schools. That has something to do with the principles by which you judge or you interpret the law. So the law is not positive, simply handed down by the state, nor is it simply a creation of human experience, but it's something which needs to be constantly interpreted in the light of your vision of justice, your vision of what society ought to be. So law is more than legalism, is what I'm suggesting. law, which Lutherans tend to emphasize. We love to preach sermons about the Pharisees who live by the law and ignore the important matters of the faith. The law has more to do with the principles. It's a community of principle. A principled community way of life is the summary kind of sentence I want to use. The law is a principled community way of life. So it has a positive and important function for Christians, and not simply a negative function, as Lutherans in particular tended to emphasize. Well, I was going to have you break up into small groups and decide a hard case yourselves and see what kind of principles came out. I don't think we have time for that. Let's plunge in with what you're thinking.
Okay. What happens with it when you start out the state and lost from God? And I kind of got, where are they at? Are they in this triangle somewhere? Or how do we get these supposedly basic natural concepts in there?
Well,
in that model.
Okay.
I'm trying to think in terms of how something like Islam presents that or something like that.
How?
Islam.
Oh, Islam.
Like that. Because they would have a model, you know. They're just squashed or white.
They would probably follow something very close to the first model I showed, which was natural law. Only in their case, they equate natural law and a state in a theocracy.
So state is natural law and the God.
Yeah. Now, I'm not an expert in Islam. You should talk to Hermann Ruther to give probably a much more nuanced understanding of it. And maybe I'm all wrong on that one. I'm just not an expert there. But that's this leg of the triangle, essentially. It would, the way it would flow there is from the state, which hands down the laws, which determine what human experience, the way that we act, according to that model. But you notice the arrows go both ways here. It's not simply, the law isn't simply a function of what the state says, but the laws, in fact, go on to condition what the state can do. As we discussed yesterday in our sanctuary infiltration suit, if you were there, or Monday in my presentation on sanctuary, I claim that the government is breaking the law in the case of sanctuary. Now, if the state simply determined what the law was, that would be a contradiction. You couldn't say that the government was breaking the law. It'd be impossible. But because the government is under law as well as creating law, well, are you all just sort of snowed with all these triangles and circles and arrows? Does any of this make sense? Is this disturbing because you thought of law as something different? Or is this sort of pull it all together and you say, oh yeah, that's all part of it. That makes sense. Where?
I'm thinking trying to figure out where different persuasions reside. I think all the religious people up in the state, very fundamental types, are, and all humanists, secular types, down in the human experience, and, are there really, just politicians, where they're at?
Well, I would claim, to take the fundamentalists, for example, who want to turn this into a Christian nation, to legislate on the basis of biblical morality, I would say that we're not really talking about enforcing the Bible. What they have, in fact, is a political theory about the ways the government, the state, our society ought to be organized. They have a vision of what they would call justice, which would eliminate free speech in the case of pornography, for example. They decide that one a whole lot further to one side than our courts do these days. And school prayer and so on. They have a theory of the way society ought to be organized and who ought to enforce what, which they want to determine what the law is, and they want the law to then affect the actions. And they want the state, they want everything to come, they want their political theory to be enforced by the state to affect human actions. The only way to counter that, in my argument, is with a competing political theory. A competing vision of what the government, what the state, what our society ought to look like. I guess I'm making two critical moves. One, I'm saying they're not talking about putting the Bible into law at all. They're really talking about a political theory, because you talk to Robert McAfee Brown, you talk to, you know, anybody who's on the teaching staff here in Bible or theology, and they're going to say that has nothing to do with what the Bible would say if you put it in the book. They're really giving their own, you know.
And yet they're hiding behind the Bible.
Hiding behind the Bible. It sort of gives it a cloak of legitimacy.
Right.
They would like to see the old natural law model, sort of a theocracy along what I was saying, that the state equals what the theologians say, hands down the law and determines what we all do. And I think it's particularly dangerous when you hide behind the Bible in that case. I want a very secular legal system. And I think that for theological reasons, I'm like two kingdoms Lutheran. Yeah.
You know, when you were talking about how in a trial situation the judge applies the law to the facts, and in my experience, most people believe that the way a judge rules in a case is that he applies the law to the facts, and out of that comes justice.
Right.
But in reality, that's not the way it works. At least it's not my experience. In my experience, what occurs is the judge first decides whose version of the facts he believes.
Mm-hmm.
And once he makes that determination, then he decides what is going to be justice. And in this case, what is the just result?
Mm-hmm.
And then after he decides what the just result is, then he goes out and finds a law. then he goes out and finds a set of laws.
Mm-hmm.
to support the decision that he's made.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's right or wrong, but that's the way the system seems to work to me.
The key activity is interpretation. It's not application. I think people tend to have a kind of a direct notion of we've got laws which apply to facts. But the problem is that the facts themselves are disputable. And the sanctuary case is an example where one side says these are the facts, the relevant facts, and the other side says, well, we don't dispute that those are facts, but they're not the most relevant facts. Here's a whole other set of facts. And the judge has interpreted one set of facts as relevant and the other as not relevant. And so the facts are problematic, but then the laws are also problematic. There's no such thing as simply the law on most cases. We don't have simply you can't simply go to a law library or your public library and look in a code book and find, you know, the section of the code which applies to your case, because our system also works by precedent. It's not only the laws put in the books by the legislatures, but it's all the past decisions of the judges who've determined what these laws are. And in some areas of law, a lot of private law, contract and property, there isn't a whole lot of laws that the legislatures have passed. It's simply the tradition of precedent. It's what judges have done in the past. How many federal judges do we have sitting? 800 some? There's a whole lot of leeway in decisions for finding the law. So the facts are problematic, they have to be interpreted. The laws are problematic, they have to be interpreted. So the whole system starts to look more and more like a case of power than it does having to do with sin, certainly, and probably not even with justice, except in the hardest cases of principle, Roe versus Wade and Brown and others. Yeah.
Is there a better legal system then?
That's a good question. Before I try to answer that, what do the rest of you think? Is there a better legal system than what we have? Well,
it seems like we've created a monster where we said it originally that law was order. It really isn't. It's almost chaotic the way we created this.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of, if you can
spaghetti
find...
spaghetti bowl of, you know, yeah. Go wherever you can make it anything you want.
If you have enough money to buy a good enough lawyer...
That's right.
...who's savvy enough to find the right judge...
That's right.
...then you can get your will enforced in the name of the law. Well, there's a little more to it than that, but go ahead.
Well, that was... When you said that, that was the thought that occurred to me earlier when I saw that overlapping of law, justice, society, and power.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems that in every society, it is the people who have the most power that get justice. Mm. I don't care what society it is, whether it's communist Russia or America, the people with the most power get justice.
Yeah.
Because they can pay more money, you hire lawyers, you spend more time researching and preparing their cases. And it's just a hard reality.
Yeah.
But I think that justice, the legal system we have in America is by far the best. It's certainly not perfect, and it certainly doesn't overcome human nature.
Yeah.
But I think it is the best.
Yeah. One of the strengths of our system, which really isn't up here in a sense, it should be more complicated yet, I'm not going to try to draw it in now, is that this relationship between law and state is really more complicated than simply a two-way arrow like that, because of our three-branch system. And we not only have common law, which is rule decisions of judges or precedent, and we not only have the acts of legislators and Congress, but we also have a constitution, which gives fundamental rights to citizens over against the government. Now, our subject on Saturday is going to be rights. It's called Rethinking Rights in the Liberal Welfare State. And what good are rights, and what danger is there to rights language in certain cases is what we want to talk about that day. Go ahead.
I don't know if this is not this awful subject or not. When did the appeal system, when did that start? I can't understand.
When was it started?
A jury makes the decision. It doesn't much change because you can appeal it and it's part of a new trial.
Yeah, well, what an appeal, what a trial does is make decisions regarding the relevant facts and an initial decision regarding the relevant laws. And the appeal, you can't question the facts anymore. You don't have the witnesses, you don't have the testimony out there you're given the testimony from the trial court, but you can raise points of law. You can say the jury or the judge, for example, a judge might have pointed out, misinterpreted the laws to the jury, and the jury went off to deliberate. And so the defense will appeal if it was a conviction and say the judge was wrong on the point of law. And the appeals court then stands over that judge. I don't know where that began. Some scholars argue for less appeal and more trust in the trial courts, particularly in serious criminal cases, where it looks like just a delay of justice. And it goes on forever and ever. Others argue otherwise, saying it's our process of appeal, which is the backbone of justice or fairness in our society, and that it does guarantee our rights and possibility of a hearing, not just one person who decides life or death, but goes to the Supreme Court that's had at least 15 judges look at it.
Yeah, it just seems to me you need to say more about political theory on the right side of that triangle, particularly against the backdrop of a rather conservative American political tradition, which it seems is, at least as Brown versus Board of Education, is being challenged.
Yes.
And as our current administration, it seems to me, is searching for that lost tradition, Hofstadter's thinking.
Well, that's interesting because it took a long time for the effects of legal realism, which was going on in the 30s, to percolate its way into the actual decisions of the courts and into a new way of understanding the way law works. Prior to that, we had positivism, essentially, which said the state makes the laws which affect actions. It wasn't a question of interpretation. Judges didn't have... the impartiality of judges, is the ideological backbone of the legal system in that way of thinking. Judges don't make laws. Judges simply rule with impartiality, blind justice, with the scales in the hand. But we started to see, through legal realism and other developments of the law, the notion that law also has to do with interpretation, that it's not simply a matter of rules which are applied, but principles which are weighed. And once you're not just applying rules, did you go 65 miles an hour? So that rule comes into effect. But what does a right to privacy mean in the case of abortion? Then you've got questions of interpretation and weighing principles. How do you weigh principles? How do you make decisions in hard cases? That has to do with a worldview. with a way, a vision of ideals of justice and fairness and so on. So that kind of stuff has percolated into political theory. People now want to claim that there are no hard cases, is essentially what the administration is claiming. In the legal system, there ought to be simply an application of the law. Kind of old-fashioned
effects of the law. Regardless of the effect of the law.
Exactly. And that's where you get someone like Antonin Scalia appointed to the court, who is really idiosyncratic. Chicago School, right, the conservative, the economic analysis of the law, is really, my professor of legal theory studied with him at Chicago, and really idiosyncratic. You don't know what the outcome is exactly going to be because he sticks so closely to his political theory, his acknowledged political theory, that it's going to come out in peculiar ways. Whereas someone like William Rehnquist has a more nuanced sense of where things come out, and even though he also would claim to be an impartial applier of laws, it comes out a little differently in his case.
Almost as if political theory has moved to the top of the triangle.
Well, probably so. In my case, that's interesting. Maybe I should redesign this. You're getting the first run through on this stuff. I haven't published this yet. This is you're thinking with me here. That's why you're the seminar group today. That's interesting. I'll have to think about that.
Oh,
that suggesting that political theory is what's really at the top now.
Yeah. I just wonder how much the justice or legal system can carry political theory.
Yeah, well, it depends.
A pluralistic society, each one's claiming that they're right. You said this is over and against feminists, liberationists, etc.
Yeah, well, it's nice to hide behind a cloak of impartiality and kind of disinterested application. Sort of look at it like science. There's laws of nature. If you drop this piece of chalk, it falls. If you do such and such, you will feel the weight of the law upon you. And you know precisely what to expect. We're looking for a kind of clear-cut approach to what law does, which says there are simply right answers. There is a right answer to every legal question. I would suggest that there are right answers, and in many cases is a right answer. But it depends on sort of which philosophy you follow. Many law professors say hard cases make bad law, and that what you do is learn all the easy cases. And then there's sort of fuzzy edges out there when it becomes a little more difficult. But you really focus on the clear-cut cases, and you've got your doctrine, your principle, which runs through the law. And what's so difficult about that? You can figure out the doctrine of personal injury or whatever it is. It's there in the easy cases. But others, and if you want to read interpretivism, the current exponent, the best one I know, is Ronald Dworkin, who had a book out this summer, Law's Empire. And he's the leading jurisprudential scholar at Oxford. Law's Empire is actually very readable. You don't have to be a legal scholar or a lawyer to understand it. He intentionally wrote it clearly and it's kind of an engaging kind of book. He brings in all the wonderful hard cases. He says that law is defined by the hard cases. And unless you can decide hard cases, you can't decide easy cases. So he wants the whole constellation of principles and interpretivism and the questions of interpretation. I am putting a lot of weight on the possibility of rational discussion about political theory. Others might argue that political theory is simply, you know, a consequence of the way you're brought up, a consequence of whether you're male or female, white or black, and so on. But I think there is such a thing as ideals of justice and fairness.
You'd agree with Richard Neuhoff.
I would on that, probably. Yep. Well, we didn't get to what this means for Lutheran theology, did we? Let me just say one word that if you're a Lutheran theologian, I suggest that this model is a model for the third use of the law. And I would support what Lutherans call the third use of the law. Namely, that law is not simply a negative thing restraining evil in society,
or a negative thing, convicting people of sin, knowing that they can't live up to everything that's expected of the law, but the law has a positive function as a principled way of life, as we saw in Deuteronomy 6. Or as Jesus put it, that we ought to follow the weightier matters of the law. That as a principled way of life, and it's political theory in this language, or it's our principles which determine how we interpret laws, that the law is a guide for Christian ethics. Not law in the sense of the U.S. code book, but this model, a way of coming at the law. Well, that's a whole other session. It's 5 o'clock. Let's have some party shots.
It sounds like in a way that this says that the law defines how we're actually living now. This point in time, maybe next week or the year after,
yep.
The law is exactly what it is. This is the way we're living now.
Right.
That's the change.
And you can change it. One of the things, exactly, you just touched on one of the things I'd underlined and started in my notes, and I forgot. One of the most important things, the previous notions of law all thought of law as a stable structure, maybe even an eternal structure. Either handed down by God, or by nature, or by the state, or by the social structure. It's all kind of a determinist model of law. But this model says law is a human creation. And the most important thing about law is the way we talk together about what's most important about law. And if law is a human creation, that means it can be changed. And prohibition is an example where law, justice, power, and sin all came together. And notions changed over the course of 14 years about whether that was a nice constellation or not. So an interpretive community of principle who talks together about what's most important to us is the positive use of the law, as far as I'm concerned. If you don't like it, talk a lot more and louder and try to change it. You can be done. Yep. Well, that's a snowstorm.